Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult-use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
Dan Perkins, and this is your American Cannabis Conversation quick news. Ann Arbor, Michigan. The line outside the Exclusive Brands dispensary in Ann Arbor, Michigan, stretched nearly three blocks on the state's first day of recreational cannabis sales this past Sunday. As a light rain fell, the store employees passed out pizza, cookies, donuts, and coffee to customers who had lined up to purchase adult-use marijuana products. Exclusive Brands owner Omar Hisham said the store served over 900 people on the first day. Most were there to purchase flower. Sales totaled $221,000 among the three stores, said David Harms, Public Information Officer of the Michigan Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. Los Angeles, California. Hopeful LA cannabis market entrants bleed money as they wait again, this time for licensing audit. The Los Angeles marijuana market is enduring more licensing delays. This time it's for the government-ordered audit of the city's cannabis regulators. This means more uncertainty for marijuana firms, and perhaps more excruciating, it means more money going down the drain. That's the ongoing narrative surrounding the LA marijuana market, where hundreds of entrepreneurs have waited months to learn if they can launch legal cannabis companies. Some, in fact, have reported losing tens of thousands of dollars paying rent on would-be licensed marijuana shops that have gone unused. And that doesn't include they have also spent on application fees or down payments on potential remodels and buildouts. All this happens while illegal shops continue to flourish in Los Angeles. And now our final story, Denver, Colorado. Some marijuana firms are rebranding in response to changing business climate. As the cannabis industry has moved to shed the stoner stereotype many have held of its consumers, several marijuana businesses are rebranding themselves via name changes and other steps to try and reflect the companies they've become. Bill Winchester, president and chief creative officer of the marketing firm Lindsay Stone and Briggs, which has offices in Madison, Wisconsin, and Minneapolis, said other potential reasons for a marijuana firm might rebrand are it launches a new and different service, the competitive landscape in the industry has shifted, and it wants to brand to reflect those changes. It wants to stress the growing professionalism surrounding the marijuana industry. And finally, the industry is changing, and from the possibility of something that is recreational and goofy to something that is more serious and medicinal. This has been your America's Cannabis Conversation quick news. I'm Dan Perkins. And coming up on today's show is Steve D'Angelo, who is known as, in many circles, as the father of legal cannabis. In addition, Dr. Jordan Tischler will talk to us in another installment on managing pain. And Megan Fox is going to talk about more and how it will affect businesses. And last but not least, we have a new guest, Emily Flippin from The Motley Fool, who works in the Marijuana Masters program. And she's going to talk about the industry, the business, and a little bit about what she does. And now the conversation continues. Welcome to the conversation. Joining us today is a founder, Steve D'Angelo, who has been involved in the development of the legal cannabis business in so many different facets, so many different ways. He's still very active in the business, and he's a lifelong believer in cannabis as an idea whose time needs to become fully illuminated, full bloom like a cannabis bloom. So welcome to the conversation, sir.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Dan. It's great to be here.
You know, it's a rare opportunity for me to speak of somebody of your stature and having the opportunity to learn from somebody who's seen it all. And so just so people understand who you are, just take a
a moment and tell the people about how broad your reach has been in the cannabis legalization, cannabis business.
Well, I started working with cannabis very young, as a teenager, and so my experience has really encompassed almost everything from street activism to producing articles out of industrial hemp, like garments and accessories, doing a lot of political work, being involved in initiatives over the years. I'm probably best known for the work I've done in California, creating three iconic cannabis businesses: Harborside, which has kind of set the gold standard for retail dispensaries. We opened in 2006, the first six licensed cannabis businesses. And then we went on to create Steep Hill Laboratory so that we could test the medicine that we were selling at Harborside, and the Arcview Group, which was intended to provide a source of capital for new cannabis startups so that we could really grow the industry.
You know, that's amazing, the diversity, what you just said already. I listened intently about what you were saying. And where did your passion come from? What was it that happened in your life that said, I got to do this?
Well, I fell in love with the cannabis plant at a very young age. I was growing up in Washington, D.C., in a civil rights household. As soon as I consumed cannabis, I knew that it was a very special thing that I wanted in my life. I also knew that I didn't want to be a criminal the rest of my life. I knew that it wasn't right to criminalize cannabis. And, you know, in the milieu I grew up in, it was the middle of the anti-war movement, the Vietnam anti-war movement, late 60s, early 70s. And it was just very natural to me that if I see a wrong, then I stand up and I try and right it.
Yeah. You know, I've had the opportunity to interview some other founders. And I know Willie Brown is quoted saying that you were the father of the legal cannabis industry. But for the longest time, it wasn't legal. And you were taking pretty great risks to be involved, especially as a young man. Before you reached the age of majority, did that scare you?
Well, you know, it was a very scary time. The earliest days of this movement were very scary. There was no such thing as legal cannabis. There weren't a lot of people who wanted to donate money to making cannabis legal. And so for many, many years, I sold cannabis without a license at fairly significant levels. And then used that money to fund things like Initiative 59 in Washington, D.C., which was Washington, D.C.'s medical cannabis initiative, or Hemp Tour, which was an effort to teach the country about industrial hemp. And, yeah, it was scary as hell. There were times in my life when I was, pretty much certain that the way that all of this was going to end up was with, me in federal prison for many, many years. But I thought that, and still think, that risk was completely acceptable in light of the alternative. Right? And I've always believed that cannabis is a force for positive social change, that it awakens people's hearts and souls. And I think that the world today is sitting at the brink of self-destruction. If we do not do something to make people kinder, more generous, closer to nature, more open to diversity and change and learning from each other, we may not have a planet to live on.
Yeah. I'm doing some research, and I found some very scary statistics. The Justice Department reports that over the last 12 months, almost one-fifth of the dispensaries in the United States have been robbed in the last 12 months of both product and cash. And they say that the average cash theft is about $273,000. As this business grows, as more and more places make it available, more and more states expand the ability to use it and get it, there's a whole new danger that is taken over. And the most riskiest place beyond a cannabis dispensary is a liquor store. And yet we have no banking laws that allow the operators in any facet of the cannabis business to deal with the cash, and yet the industry is growing at 35% a year. We have a friend who owns a bunch of dispensaries in Sacramento, had three of his dispensaries robbed in one weekend. So 30% of his businesses were robbed in one weekend this past summer. So there's a different kind of risk. You know, when you were starting, there was the government risk and possible prison time. But now there's a physical risk. We have the House passing the Safe Banking Act, but it doesn't seem to be moving at the moment in the Senate. And then we had over the last week, we had the House Judiciary Committee pass the MORE Act on deregulation. And now that appears that it's got some serious trouble in getting through the Senate. So what do you think about the problem of cash and the lack of banking, and then the most recent discussion with the House Judiciary Committee on the MORE Act?
The continuing lack of basic regulations that stems from the refusal of the federal government to fully legalize cannabis impacts on many, many different levels. So one of them is banking. You're absolutely correct. Whenever you have a shop that does a large amount of turnover in cash, the local folks who like to rob places learn about that and will target it, whether it's a casino, whether it's a liquor store, whether it's a cannabis dispensary. Those things will happen. The difference with cannabis is that while every other business is allowed to take the majority of their sales in credit cards and debit cards in a form that they can't be robbed of, the cannabis industry, for the most part, because of the lack of banking services, is forced to operate on cash, and that exposes us to a greatly heightened risk. Despite that, what the data also shows is that the rate of crime in neighborhoods immediately surrounding licensed dispensaries drops. In Harborside, relative to before we opened, our crime rate dropped about 36% after we opened the dispensary. So even though we have this challenge of operating solely on cash, the industry has understood that threat and been quite effective at taking steps to mitigate it. I'm not sure about the 30% figure from the Department of Justice. You know, the one thing that we know about the Department of Justice is this, is that every word that comes out of their mouth about cannabis is a lie, and those lies are usually designed to spread fear and hysteria. So in my experience, 30% is way higher than the actual number is.
So what about, before we go, we've got a few minutes left. How do people follow you? How do they get in touch with you? What's the best way for them, our listeners, to do that?
Well, there's a number of ways. I'm very active on social, on a number of different platforms. The best way to figure out those platforms is to go to stevedeangelo.com. Spelled pretty much the way it sounds. You can also learn about my most important passion project right now is a project called the Last Prisoner Project. And this is a new nonprofit advocacy organization that has an ambitious but very simple purpose, and that is to make sure that every single cannabis prisoner in this country and around the world comes home to their families as part of legalizing cannabis.
And how does that fit with the MORE Act? Is it compatible with it? Is it different?
Well, it's different. There's, you know, there are some issues. I think that the MORE Act I anticipates expungement, if I'm remembering correctly, but does not anticipate clemency. And so here's the issue is that when cannabis reform laws are passed, they almost never contain any kind of provision to release people who were incarcerated prior to the change in the law. And this is true in California, it's true in Colorado, it's true in Illinois. So we have thousands of people in states that have legalized cannabis who are still sitting in prison. Some of them are in on state charges. There's other people who are in on federal charges. We are focusing initially on convincing the governors of cannabis legal states to release people who are convicted of things that aren't crimes anymore.
So do you have any hope for the MORE Act getting through the Senate, or that's just not your focus, and you're not focused on that at all at the moment?
If it's cannabis, I'm focused on it. The world of cannabis gets broader all the time, so that becomes a bit of a challenge. But no, I think that the Moore Act is going to be challenged by the Senate mainly. I think that it will get through the House. I think it'll hit the Senate. I think it's going to be very, very challenging to get it through the Senate. If it did get through the Senate, my sense of it is that Trump would probably sign it. He's made numerous statements to the effect that he would sign cannabis legislation that came out of Congress. My trajectory for reform at the federal level is really tied to what happens in the next general election. If we get any Democrat other than Bloomberg or Biden, then we will see the legalization of cannabis in a fairly short period of time. If we get stuck with Bloomberg or Biden, then they will do what the Democratic elite has always done, which is give lip service to the cannabis movement, meanwhile doing everything they can to stall our forward momentum and try to push us backward if they can. But if any of the other candidates, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Tulsi Gabbard, anybody, all of these candidates have endorsed in a very explicit way full federal legalization. So I'd expect to see it within the first year of any of those administrations. If Trump wins another term, I think he will continue what his policy has been, which is cannabis is not something he spends political capital on one way or another. He's not going to take actions on cannabis that would cost him votes. But he's also not going to do anything to push the issue forward in a way that he would have to spend any of his political capital. So it will be, in any case, it will be up to all of the activists working around the country to push this forward. And to be frank with you, the one of the biggest single things that is blocking us from effectively addressing federal reform is the very, very low level of donations that the cannabis reform movement has received from the new cannabis industry. It's really quite shocking that people are building intergenerational wealth, and at the same time, many of them are not donating to change federal law or even to get prisoners released.
One more time, Steve, how do people follow you? How do they get a hold of you?
SteveDeAngelo.com. And lastprisonerproject.org on Instagram. You can get me at Steve DeAngelo.
We'll be right back.
A programming note, Steve DeAngelo was a great interview to listen to and understand the history of the cannabis business. Stay tuned because later in the show, we're going to hear from our new columnist, Emily Flippin from Motley Fool, on what she thinks might be the best opportunities for investing in cannabis for the long term. This is Dan Perkins. America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network, W420 Radio Network, is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing teams. America's Cannabis Conversation, which airs each Saturday at 4:20, offers listeners insight and information on the exploding cannabis industry. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach hyper-targeted audiences, literally neighborhood by neighborhood. We are looking for motivated individuals who want to start their own businesses in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To get more information on this opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is our regular Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association. And we're here to talk about specifically the Moore legislation that was reported out of the House Judiciary Committee, ultimately going for a floor vote. Morgan, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.
Talk to us about the Moore Act.
I think that it's pretty significant, not only in terms of the potential for actually getting something done in the near future regarding cannabis legalization, but also symbolically. So the Moore Act would basically deschedule cannabis and remove it from the Schedule of Controlled Substances under the Controlled Substances Act and allow the federal government to regulate it as they choose. It would also establish a cannabis justice department that would then it basically puts a 5% tax on all legal cannabis commerce in order to fund grant programs, expungement, and social equity programs at the federal, state, and local level. It allows the Small Business Administration to provide grants to small cannabis businesses. It allows doctors within the Veterans Affairs system to be able to recommend medical cannabis to their patients in accordance with applicable state laws, and it automatically expunges any federal cannabis-related convictions for anybody that's not currently incarcerated, and allows for people to that are incarcerated to be able to redress their cases through the Department of Justice. So this is really a one of the most forward-thinking and comprehensive cannabis policy bills that we've seen ever. And it was also the first time that the Judiciary Committee, as well as really any committee in the House, had actually had a markup on a bill to legalize cannabis and remove it from the schedule of controlled substances. So this is a really big deal. And, you know, it got bipartisan support, although much more Democrat support than Republican. There were two Republicans that did vote yes on it. And basically where we're at now is that there are a number of other committees that have jurisdiction in the House, and they can choose to either hold hearings and markups on it themselves or to waive that right in order to speed it to a floor vote.
We're speaking with Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association about the MORE Act that was passed by the Judiciary Committee. Just so I understand what you said, is the Judiciary Committee the wrong place for it to have originated, or does it make any difference? Because you talked about other committees that had jurisdiction, so I wasn't quite sure what you were trying to say there.
Well, the bill's original sponsor, Jerry Nadler from New York, is actually the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. Any bill dealing with legalization would have to go through Judiciary at some point, so I think that it's totally fine for it to start there. And when we were talking about cannabis banking earlier this year in the House, a lot of people were concerned that just passing banking was going to slow down momentum for more comprehensive reforms, particularly those that included additional social justice provisions beyond what was included in the Safe Banking Act in and of itself. So I think that Chairman Nadler was very, very keen to make sure that that did not happen, and to make sure that the momentum kept going. So I think that it's excellent that he honored the agreements and promises that he made to advocates on the Hill to actually bring this up for a markup and to start this conversation on a much more serious footing than has happened in the past. So I think that we're really in a good position right now where we've got a lot of forward momentum. And even if nothing happens again this year with all of Congress being taken up by a lot of different issues and running short on time, we're in a really good position to start the next legislative year.
Do you think that this bill would actually pass the House as it's currently illustrated, or would it have to be changed dramatically?
I think that it could stand a very strong chance of passing in the House if we were to come up to a floor vote today. We'd like to see more robust and clearly defined regulatory language amended in the bill, and we're going to be working with the other committees of jurisdiction to see if we can get something like that introduced as laid out in the recommendations that we released back in October that basically divide cannabis products into four different lanes and then assign chief regulatory responsibilities to those based on the expertise of those agencies. And, we're hopeful that we can get that language introduced in the near future, but it's really questionable about whether there's going to be enough time for even any more hearings or markups on this bill, given that the House still has to work on a final budget for the year, and they have to have that passed by, I believe, December 20th in order to keep the government running. And the fact that there's all sorts of other political things going on, and like I said, the calendar is the window is rapidly shrinking for any normal business to get done in Congress. So to answer your question, though, I think that it very easily could pass. It'll be interesting to see what happens in committee. There will probably be all sorts of amendments added by people who are on the fence about it, or by Republican opposition to try to strip out a lot of its restorative justice power. But whether or not those amendments will actually stay in for any sort of final version that gets a full House vote, I think is pretty doubtful.
This new word that's been buzzing around, this MORE Act, is expungement. And you touched on it a little bit early in this interview. Could you be a little more specific about what the bill says about expungement?
Well, so when the bill passes, as soon as it's implemented, it dictates that there will be immediate expungement for anybody that has been arrested for or has been convicted of cannabis-related behavior, you know, particularly distribution and possession. So this is only applies to federal charges, and it doesn't apply to anybody who is currently incarcerated, but it does provide mechanisms for people to challenge those rulings who are incarcerated and be able to have their cases addressed and potentially have their sentences either vacated or shortened. You know, this is really a great move, but at the same time, the vast majority of arrests for cannabis take place at the state and local level. So it really doesn't address a lot of the unnecessary criminalization that happened to cannabis consumers and people that were involved in, you know, at the time was an entirely unregulated market. That being said, there is language in the bill that allows for this newly formed Cannabis Justice Department to be able to help fund state level expungement programs as well.
So when we're talking about expungement, is that likely to be a major sticking point with the Republicans?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a contingent that really is, you know, coming from a law and order standpoint, where if somebody knowingly broke the law, then they should deal with the penalties for that. But I think that more and more people are realizing that cannabis prohibition has been enforced really unequally. And so in order to address that, it's going to be necessary to vacate and expunge a lot of those penalties that weren't doled out evenly to everybody, depending on, you know, race and socioeconomic background. So, you know, some of them might consider it a sticking point, but I don't think that a majority of Republicans do. And regardless, the Democrats currently control the House, and I don't think that there are very many Democrats at all that view that as a sticking point.
So if we look at that, the issue is the people in jail currently, you said, are there primarily because of state issues. Are we going to have to knock these off one state at a time in order to get expungement down to the state level?
Well, I think that that is going to be up to the states. However, as I said, there are mechanisms in order to obtain funding in order to help those programs. And, you know, really at the state level, this is becoming almost a non-issue. You know, back in 2012, when I was working on the campaign to legalize marijuana in Colorado, you know, we were doing a lot of polling around whether or not we could include some sort of expungement or retroactive amnesty in the language of that bill. And the polling showed that it was an across-the-board bill killer, that there was no way it was going to pass as long as there were any sort of amnesty or expungement provisions written into the initiative language. You know, fast forward to just this year, where, you know, any sort of legalization bills that don't contain expungement or some form of restorative justice provisions at the state level are pretty much non-starters. So I think that, you know, as a country, we've really come a long way on this particular issue.
So we're speaking with Morgan Fox about the MORE Act. We had the other piece of legislation, which was the Safe Banking Act. Is that doing anything in the Senate?
Well, the Senate calendar just came out a few days ago, and it does not include anything about any sort of cannabis banking. But we are working to make sure that you know, there will be a hearing this year, and if we can't get one this year, then in Q1 of next year. But I think it's important to recognize that you know, up until like a week or two ago, the Senate Banking Committee hadn't actually held a markup on any bill in almost 2 years. So this is a process, and you know, I think that as we get closer to the end of the year, and you know, really start getting into January and February, and Senate leadership starts looking at the political landscape, there is going to be a lot more appetite for addressing this issue, which you know, is not only politically popular among voters of all political stripes, but also could significantly help the chances of reelection for people like Cory Gardner.
We're speaking with Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association. Morgan, how can people follow you?
We're available on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and our website is thecannabisindustry.org.
Thank you, Morgan, for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
This is Dan Perkins, your host and co-creator of America's Cannabis Conversation. Before we introduce our guest, I want to take a moment to tell you why we started this groundbreaking network and show. Hundreds of thousands of people who work in the cannabis industry trying to help people are not permitted to tell their story on the public airways of radio and TV. In spite of these restrictions, the American cannabis industry is growing at about 35% per year and accelerating. As you listen to this show from time to time, you will hear real people telling their story of how cannabis helped them, or business people who grew their business. When I started talking to people in the exploding cannabis business and telling them what we were trying to do, I heard this common question: when can you help me? Well, we are going to give you a voice. We promise to do our best to bring you a high-value, entertaining program. We want from you what you want from your customers. Come back for more. And now, let's meet our guest. Welcome back to America's Cannabis Conversation. And our doctor, Dr. Jordan Tischler, is in the studio talking with us today, continuing of our previous conversation about dealing with pain management and how cannabis can use it. So, doctor, I'm going to put you on the spot. The idea of an older group of people like myself are having sometimes having trouble with their general practitioners, their doctors, when they talk to them about the possibility of whether or not cannabis would work in their pain management. And I said to you previously that my wife had hip surgery, and when we talked to the doctor about pain management, he did a Jekyll and Hyde when she mentioned the possibility of cannabis, and he was actually rude, I think would be a fair discussion. So, doctor, how do we as patients who want to take more control of our own care find a doctor who has the compassion to help us find whatever the treatment is necessary? How do we go about doing that? And then how do you as a practitioner decide which strain of cannabis that you need to treat somebody with for pain?
These are great questions. I'm not sure we're going to get through all of them in a 10-minute segment, but let me see what I can say in that period of time. The first thing I would say is I'm sorry that your wife had this negative interaction with her surgeon. There's really no excuse for his being rude, other than the fact that he's a human being like anyone else and perhaps felt uncomfortable with this discussion, largely, I would guess, because he doesn't know very much about it. The reality here is that many physicians don't know a whole lot about it. I would like to think that most of them, in not knowing much about it, would get to the point where they would educate themselves a little bit about it, and not necessarily that they would prescribe it for your wife, for example, because they may still feel out of their league, but at least know enough to say this is a legitimate medicine and here's somebody I trust as your doctor to send you to who can help you with the details. So what I call that is a cannabis specialist. And I started an organization a while back called the Association of Cannabis Specialists. And the goal there was to find doctors who knew this stuff and who cared and would be present and helpful to their patients, specifically around cannabis care. And that's been pretty successful. So let me give you some more information. The Association of Cannabis Specialists is available on the web at cannabis-specialist.org. Again, cannabis-specialist.org. And on that site, amongst many other things that you might want to explore, is a directory of doctors who not only are members, but in becoming members, are up to speed on the data, and most importantly, have taken a pledge to treat their patients in an ethical manner, which means not only knowing about cannabis, but also not being sort of the kind of doctor that's just going to give you a card and then say, go talk to the 20-year-old bud tender. you know, to your question about strains and such like that, that's a much longer discussion, but I'm going to try to encapsulate it very quickly and simply say strains are not important. Strains are a marketing device for selling weed. So this is something that your cannabis specialist should be sitting down and talking over with you. Dosing and route of administration, those are very important for getting the best result for pain relief or any other symptom that we're treating with cannabis. But the strains themselves really are just chemically too similar for there to be a significant medical difference. Now, that doesn't mean that people don't develop a preference for one over the other, but it's not the same as did it help your back pain, which is really a medical outcome. And so I think that this leads us into a potentially another segment for another day, which is sort of the smoke and mirrors that are involved in the industry and the ways in which those things sell lots of products but aren't necessarily to the best advantage of patients who are not looking for something that's kind of interesting. They're really looking for something that's reliable and effective. And so I would argue that patients and recreational users are both equally legitimate but have very different needs and therefore need very different treatment and different products and such like that. And that's not something the industry has really got a good handle on at the moment.
Let me follow that with a question, if I might.
I could put in one sentence quickly.
Sure.
Back
right
on
ahead.
Your wife. One of the things that often gets brought up at the dispensary is CBD, right? And CBD, we could do a whole segment on that. But just thinking about your wife, and you mentioned some blood thinners and such like that, CBD is contraindicated for her. The bud tender, who's a 20-year-old, who, at least in Massachusetts, where I'm familiar with the regulations, is required to have a high school diploma or equivalent and nothing more, is likely to say, if you say, I have hip pain, here's a bottle of CBD. But that's actually potentially dangerous for your wife and for many other patients if they're taking it and taking enough of it. So, again, I often say, look, the bud tenders mean well, they're nice people, they're very friendly, but basically they are educated on the subject to the level of a Starbucks barista. So if you wouldn't ask your barista your health questions, probably you shouldn't be asking the bud tenders.
Well, that brings up a question, and that is, in the 11 states where adult use is legal, you don't need a doctor, you don't need a prescription to buy cannabis in the dispensary. So do we have a risk of self-medication with people who really don't know what they're doing?
Absolutely. At some point we have a unique situation in that here is a substance that has true medical benefit as well as true recreational benefit and is sort of more or less freely available. And so, yes, we can definitely find ourselves in the position where not only patients may choose to self-medicate, but there's a huge amount of marketing pressure with lots of dollars behind it which is out there trying to convince people that they should self-medicate or that they should get their advice from the bud tender. And the problem with that is that fundamentally the reason that marketing is going on is because that sells more weed. Whereas if you go to the doctor, who tends to be, shall we say, thoughtful and conservative and really focusing on precision dosing, that tends to actually lead to less use. And so there is a little bit of a conflict there, and there's a lot of messaging that's going to point sick people in the wrong direction. And I see this a lot because, sometimes patients come to me and I tell them, here's what I think you need to do. And then they go to the store and the store people tell them something else, and that invariably doesn't end well. Or alternately, they went, like you mentioned, sort of through the recreational system, or maybe they got a card from some other doctor who didn't give them any guidance, and then they use it, and it doesn't work, or they feel sick, or any of those sorts of things. Then they come to me. They say, "Doc, I tried all this stuff. What happened?" And then I look at what they tried, and it's either something that I would have predicted is ineffective, dangerous, or just way too much. So I think that, you know, there is that conflict between what the industry would like people to do and what's sort of really medically best for them. And I guess at the end of the day, it's going to come down to each patient having to think this through for themselves. And I'm hopeful that, as you say, most of this group are older people with some maturity, and I hope that most of them will look at their doctors, particularly their cannabis specialist, as somebody that they are going to for advice and guidance, and value that advice and guidance, so that then they end up with, you know, best outcome.
So we've been talking with Dr. Jordan Tischler, our cannabis doctor on call. And one more time, doctor, how can people get a hold of you?
You can find me on the web at inhalemd.com, or you can call at 617-477-8886.
So we've got about a little more than 2 minutes left in this program, and I want to ask you the question. One of the things I put up front was, how do you decide which product a person should use, or does it make any difference?
I mean, if we're going to generalize to product more so than strains, it absolutely does make a difference. And I would start with the idea that, you know, there are different types of pain. And what product we use and how we use it depends a little bit on what we're treating. So somebody who has pain, for example, from something that's acute and episodic, like a migraine headache, those people – generally speaking, would do best with cannabis by inhalation. And the reason for that is inhaled cannabis has a very quick onset, which is good if you're having a horrible migraine come on. It also doesn't last super long, lasts about 3 or 4 hours, which if your headache has now gone away, it's good for the medicine to kind of go away. On the other hand, somebody who has osteoarthritis of their spine and who's miserable kind of 24/7 as a result, that's somebody where the quick onset, short duration is going to lead to kind of a yo-yo effect. I feel better, it wore off. Oh, now I took some more, I feel better again. Up, down, up, down. That's not generally thought to be a good approach to pain control. So something that we take by mouth, which has kind of the opposite characteristics to the inhaled stuff, in that it's slow to start working, but when it works much longer, like 8 to 12 hours, that's going to give us more of that continuous pain coverage that we're really looking for, that allows people to take the medicine and then go on about their lives.
Well, so that you may be able to get the same strain in an edible or oil or something you can smoke and vape or not. I don't know about that. I know it's been banned in Massachusetts for a while. But so it sounds like what you're saying, depending upon the kind of pain you're trying to treat, then you have to have more concern about the delivery system, how you get it into your system and how your system manages it, than what brand of cannabis it really is.
Yes, that's absolutely
correct. True?
The route of administration is hugely important, and the dosing is really important. You know, if you get your advice from somebody who's a heavy user, they're going to say, you know, go ahead and use like I use, but that's going to be too much for somebody who isn't, you know, a long-term user, and it's also more than is likely necessary. Again, from a medical approach, you know, less is more. What we want is to find that sweet spot right at the place where we get the maximum benefit with a minimum of side effects. And the side effects that we really need to think about primarily is that intoxication. All medicines have side effects, and cannabis is no different. Cannabis can cause some intoxication, and that's just a side effect we need to manage. We have to view it that way so it's not upsetting or concerning. And I think that the key is that if we're dosing this properly, that place where we're getting maximum benefit is effective for the pain or whatever else we're treating, And quite frankly, that modicum of intoxication really isn't all that impressive or intrusive. And it's the sort of thing that once you're over sort of the initial concerns about it, it doesn't bother people any longer.
This has been just great conversation. It was everything that I hoped it would be. And I appreciate your time and your interest in our listeners. Just in case, ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't hear all of today's interview with Dr. Jordan, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com, and you can find the archive section and download this show and the previous show and look for notifications about the next visit from the doctor on call, Dr. Jordan Tischler. Thank you so much for your help and your advice and your time today.
This is Dan Perkins with your American Cannabis Conversation. Breaking news. A Canadian study finds everyday marijuana use reduces opioid consumption by chronic pain patients. The report authors said that they found that people who use cannabis every day had about a 50% lower odds of using illicit opioids every day compared to cannabis of non-users. Stephanie Lake, a PhD candidate at the University of British Columbia School of Population and Public Health and co-author of the study, said over the study period, 455 people reported using heroin or other illicit pharmaceuticals daily through at least one of the 6 months follow-up periods in the cohort study. Meanwhile, 410 said they use cannabis daily at the time of their initial interview when chronic pain was first reported, and 583 participants said they were using marijuana either daily or occasionally, while 269 said that they were using non-medical opioids every day. Using a statistical model, researchers found that the daily cannabis use was significantly and negatively associated with daily illicit opioid use. When chronic pain patients participated in the program to reduce their opioid use with medical marijuana, a quarter of them completely stopped taking opioid medication within a half a year. A new pilot study reports after 6 months, 26% ceased taking opioids. About 70% said they use medical marijuana as a substitute for prescription drugs, 35% for opioids, 11% for antidepressants, 8% for anti-seizure medications, and 4% for sleeping pills. This has been your America's Cannabis Conversation Breaking News. I'm Dan Perkins.
Welcome to the conversation. We have a new and exciting and interesting guest, somebody that I've been trying to get on the show for months, and we finally hooked up, and we're going to do some stuff on a regular basis. Let me introduce you, my audience, to Emily Flippin from The Motley Fool. Welcome to the conversation, Emily.
Hi, Dan. Thank you again so much for having me on. I'm looking forward to our chat.
I have used The Motley Fool services in my private investment practice on and off for years, long time. Let's help people understand what it is from the 30,000 feet. What does Motley Fool do and who do they do it for?
Sure thing. The Motley Fool is an investment advisory service focused on retail investors. And its name actually comes from the Shakespearean play, As You Like It, where the fool was the only one who was able to speak truth to the king without getting his head lopped off. So the Motley Fool, what they're trying to do is really just provide great financial advice, whether that be stock picking advice, personal finance advice, in a way that's fun and entertaining and accessible to the average investor.
With that being said, do you simply provide a recommendation, or do you also provide execution?
No execution provided. We are a stock picking service for the most part, although our business does have many different facets. But the group that I work on, which is our investing team, provides stock advice for mostly retail investors. So we're not actually the ones executing the trade for anybody, but we are providing advice. Some of our real money portfolios provide allocation advice. Some of our cheaper portfolios just provide stock picking advice. But the intent is to provide good financial advice to the average person, yeah, that's accessible and easy to understand.
Terrific. And do you charge a flat fee, or how do you get paid from your retail customers?
Well, we think one of the worst things that anybody can do who's an individual investor is give up a percentage of their assets for somebody to manage their money, especially if they're capable of managing their money on their own. So we are a flat fee subscription-based service. The pricing is you know, paid up front, and you get access to our investors and our best stock ideas.
That's the way I've used it, and I've been very pleased with the service over the years that I've used it. Now,
that's great.
One of the reasons I wanted to have your company, and now that I've got you on the show, is that I've been in the business of managing money for close to 50 years. And as I said, I was a fairly early adopter of Motley Fool for their research. But I have to say, Emily, I have never seen a period of time with so much focus from Motley Fool on a singular sector that I have seen almost daily somewhere an advertisement for cannabis stocks. Am I just in the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place at the right time? Or is that an area where your company actually believes it's a very significant opportunity?
I genuinely believe, and I feel like my company shares that belief, that it's a big, significant opportunity. You mentioned that you don't remember in the history of you know, being a customer of the Motley Fool, us ever being this enthusiastic about a particular industry. And I feel like that's representative of the fact that an industry like this doesn't come along very often. And what's really unique about the cannabis industry is that institutional investors, for the most part, don't get involved. It's still illegal at a federal level in the U.S. So it's a market that's really catered towards retail investors right now, which is right up our alley. And it's a market that people really need advice on. There's a lot of bad advice out there, and a lot of investors have lost their shirts taking bad advice in the cannabis industry. So it's a really big opportunity for us as a business to better serve our customers and hopefully save them from making some of the worst mistakes you can make while investing in the cannabis industry.
We're talking with Emily Flippin from the Motley Fool. And why don't we just take this moment, Emily, to tell people how they can get in touch with Motley Fool and potentially follow you.
We're always accessible on our website, which is fool.com, F-O-O-L.com. But I'm also on Twitter. So, you know, if anything I say strikes a fancy with anyone, you can find me on Twitter. I believe my username on Twitter is Emily_Flippin. So come find me. You can tweet at me, and I'll be happy to respond.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And while I'm thinking about it, if you are late coming into this interview, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com, the website, and go to the archive section, and you can listen to this entire interview with Emily and all of the shows that have been broadcast. So let's get back. Let's talk about how long have you been at Motley Fool and what is it that you do?
I've been at the Motley Fool for just under 2 years, and I actually work on their investing team focused on growth style investing. So the cannabis industry to me is really kind of the ultimate growth style industry. So any investor that is invested in growth companies should probably take a serious look at the cannabis industry. That's not to say that every investor needs to have exposure, but the work that I do here at the Fool is mostly focused upon analyzing cannabis companies, analyzing the cannabis industry, making cannabis stock picks, along with services that I also work on that are more focused on other types of growth opportunities. But I would say the majority of my time is spent analyzing the cannabis industry because I just see so much opportunity there.
So I want to go back to something you said because everything you say is important, but this was particularly struck me, that the institutional investors, because of the illegal nature of cannabis at the federal level, are not players in this space. Are they players in Canada? Do you know?
Not as much as you may think. I think that the stigma that's associated with cannabis investments still is really off-putting to a lot of institutional investors. While we have seen a lot of ETFs mostly come out focused around the cannabis industry, virtually all of them have lost a significant amount of money. And so it's no surprise that we're seeing so much trepidation from institutional investors to get into the space. But what I think is really interesting is that while we're seeing pullbacks from institutional investors, not, you know, a lack of willingness to take the risk and the volatility that comes with cannabis, we're actually seeing a fair number of high net worth individuals choose to take that risk themselves. So while their money managers or asset managers aren't willing to do it for them, they're doing it for themselves.
You know, it's interesting listening to what you were saying there, because we kind of have to split for our audience institutional investors we can look at institutional investors, and we can call them mutual funds, private equity investors, hedge funds, all that stuff. But there's another institutional investor which I would suggest is not ignoring the cannabis, and that is companies like Altria and Coors Brewing and Constellation Brands. They're very interested in fact, buying thousands of acres of growing fields for cannabis. So that side of the institutional business seems to be quite strong, and there's a lot of, as we think about consolidation in this industry, which inevitably happens in an excessively strong growing group of companies, right now the companies are being bought by other companies, not in the traditional investment banking underwriting, again, because of the nature of what's being acquired. So companies are doing this business without investment bankers, per se.
Yeah, it's really interesting. But what I think is interesting is that basically all those examples you mentioned, and there are other ones too, Anheuser-Busch with Tilray, for instance, all of those happened about a year ago. So it's been a while since we've seen more money come into the space, and companies, especially companies like Constellation Brands, have taken major hits both to their bottom line and their stock price as a result of the investment that they've made in cannabis. Now, at no point do I think those are bad investments. I think, you know, they've been questionable investments for the past year because the cannabis industry has been so challenged. But it's interesting to see the kind of pullback that we're actually seeing from a lot of these larger companies as a result of a lacking enthusiasm for the cannabis industry, at least as it stands right now.
Well, I would say to you that I was surprised and confused that when the vape crisis came, Altria took a $4.5 billion write-down in their investment in the vaping business, and I thought that based on the news that was coming out, that it more and more leaned towards the illegal market, the vape industry that they bought into was perfectly legal, did not have any issues of lung disease or death. I think they pulled the trigger too fast.
I don't disagree with that sentiment. They were being likely proactive from a legal perspective and taking that write down. That's a write down that they can't write back up. So it had significant impact on their business. But it is to say that I think what they're seeing in this space right now is a lot of concern around vaping, a lot of unwarranted concern around vaping. But it's a testament to the fact that, you know, sure, it's a huge write down. It's not their entire investment into Juul,
right,
but it's a representative effect of what we're seeing in terms of the market situation for Juul right now, which is to say that Juul is facing a lot of legal trouble. And I think what Altria wanted to do was protect themselves a little bit from the fallout associated with the Juul regulatory issues.
We've been talking with Emily Flippen from The Motley Fool. And how can they follow you or get information about what you do?
Sure thing. You can always go to our website, which is fool.com, or feel free to find me on Twitter. I love having conversations, especially about pot stocks. So anytime you want to talk pot, I'll be there on Twitter.
Thank you so much, Emily, for joining us today.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network, W420 Radio Network, is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing teams. America's Cannabis Conversation, which airs each Saturday at 4:20, offers listeners insight and information on the exploding cannabis industry. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach hyper-targeted audiences, literally neighborhood by neighborhood. We are looking for motivated individuals who want to start their own businesses in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To get more information on this opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
We hope you enjoyed the conversation today and invite you to join us next week. So go to the website, americascannabisconversation.com, download shows, and look who's going to be on next week. This is Dan Perkins, and thanks for joining the conversation.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.